ongoing appeal has taken him into uncharted legal territory, challenging not only a conviction, but the authority of the U.S. Supreme Court itself. Welcome to the program, Joseph.
Hi, great to be here.
So, Joseph, now plea deals are becoming more common up here in Canada. Can you describe what the system of plea bargaining was designed to accomplish for American justice and just what it has delivered since?
If every individual who was charged went to trial, then the court system would be very, very quickly overwhelmed with cases, and it would essentially grind to a halt. What it's become now is a system where there is what's colloquially known as a trial tax, such that district attorneys or prosecutors will do what's called stacking charges. They will essentially charge a defendant with every single thing they can conceivably charge that person with, and then offer to drop some of those charges in exchange for a guilty plea. The problem is that, you know, under the American system, juries are supposed to be part and parcel to the criminal justice process. And when you exclude juries from the process, you create a system where essentially the prosecutors are running the show entirely, and they're leveraging pleas from individuals, from defendants that may or may not be guilty at all, based on this threat of, well, if you decide to go to trial, you know, you're going to have this trial tax imposed upon you. And instead of doing maybe 2 years, you're going to do 15 years. So the incentive is for a lot of people to just plead guilty, even if they're not guilty, because rolling the dice on a trial means, you know, you could spend 3, 4, 5 times as much time in jail or in prison as you would if you simply pled guilty. Whether or not you're guilty or you're innocent is really immaterial to the prosecutors, is my understanding.
Well, there's a kind of insane logic here too, that if somebody decides not to plead out and they lose their case and they get this massive sentence, they're going to, if it's all about saving money to the courts, and they're going to cost the state a lot more sitting in jail somewhere.
Right. That's absolutely true. So I don't think it's about saving money as much as it is about making the job of prosecutors easier. And ultimately, you know, from what I see, in my opinion, this is done just to essentially boost the prosecutor's career. It increases conviction rates. It can springboard them to, you know, being elected as the county attorney or district attorney or a state attorney general, or, you know, even being a judge. I mean, a lot of judges are former prosecutors. Many more judges are former prosecutors than there are former criminal defense attorneys.
But at least those have studied the law. The way I understand it down in the States, that the judiciary is a political position that judges can be elected to that have no legal training at all. Is that right?
There are some states that permit that. Arizona permits, where I'm at, Arizona permits what's called justice court judges, justices of the peace, persons that have no legal training whatsoever, permits them to be to hold a position in the judiciary. And it's supposed to be a relatively unimportant role. But the problem is that justices of the peace, in Arizona at least, are the ones who run the initial appearance. So they're the ones that are setting bond initially. They're the ones that are making probable cause determinations. So you have a situation where you might have someone with no legal training, no experience whatsoever, who is elected to this position, who is making critical decisions about a defendant. You know, whether or not to grant bail or bail amount is a critical decision. Whether or not there's probable cause is a critical decision. And so, you know, you get into the situations where there's just almost Kafka-esque system of people who have no idea what they're doing, making these decisions about defendants.
Well, and the political element that's introduced here, how does that affect which cases get, what kind of treatment different types of cases get? Cases, well, that might be more politically, you know, popular, yes, to prosecute than otherwise.
Yes. So, you know, from, at least I can't speak for every state, but in Arizona, domestic violence is a huge, huge, huge one. No one wants to be seen as soft on domestic violence. So, you know, In domestic violence cases, the defendant is not going to be granted, pretrial diversion. They're gonna hit that person with everything they have. The problem is that, in the United States and Arizona especially, domestic violence is defined so broadly that it encompasses all kinds of conduct that is not in any manner violent. For instance, in Arizona, it would be domestic violence if you were playing your car stereo too loud at a parenting exchange, a custody exchange, and it bothered the other parent. That would be domestic violence. Domestic violence could be getting your child a haircut if you have shared custody without without notifying the other parent or without getting permission from the other parent. That's violation of a court order. And if the other person on that court order is your former spouse, then that's domestic violence. So there's this huge swath of conduct that, while is technically criminal, it's not domestic violence. But in Arizona, and in many other places, it is domestic violence because, that's what gets the funding is, we had X number of domestic violence prosecutions and we had X number of convictions. So now you're getting these VAWA grants, which is the Violence Against Women Act, getting these federal grants, you're getting state grants, you're getting DOJ money because you've shown, yes, we are tough on domestic violence, when there's no distinction made as to what the domestic violence actually entails. Obviously, an aggravated assault committed against your ex-spouse is a lot different than playing loud music at a custody exchange. But domestic violence is just a blanket term, at least in Arizona, that doesn't differentiate between the two.
Well, and if I'm a prosecutor that has ambitions to higher office or elected office down the road, I want to make sure that I don't have embarrassments in my record and letting crimes that are politically unpopular slip past me.
Well, exactly. You don't ever want to be seen as soft on, domestic violence, because, when you're running your campaign, your opponent is going to say, he let X number of domestic violence prosecutions go to diversion, and he's soft on crime, and he's not about protecting women and families. And, it is just when you interject or you inject politics into the criminal justice system, you've doomed the system to failure at that point. And politics have no place in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, there was once upon a time a separation of powers, and that at least is the same in this country as in the United States.
That went away.
Well, and this isn't incidental that you're bringing up this. This is not just an example. This is the essence of the case against you. And does it make it difficult for you to get press coverage like we're having here today when, you say, oh, well, this is a domestic violence case. Are people, do they shrink away from you and think, no, I don't want to touch this this issue?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, there's no amount of explaining that one can do. It's like having the mark of being a sex offender. There's a connotation when you say the word sex offender that it's some, deviant, sexual deviant, rapist, child molester, whatever.
But that's not the case for you.
No.
let's not add to this.
So my case was essentially my son told, and I had shared custody with my ex-wife. My son told me that my ex-wife's boyfriend was abusing him. And I filed a police report. The police spoke to my ex-wife.
How old was your son, Joseph?
My son was 5 at the time. And I'd never known my son to be a liar or to make up stories. And so the police spoke to his mother, who said, oh, yeah, he just fell. There was nothing going on. And then they closed the case. And then I told my son, I was taking him back to his mother, and he started crying. I'd been a family law paralegal in Arizona for more than 5 years at that point. So I was well acquainted with, all of the family law statutes, and including the statutes on custody and withholding custody. And, I knew that, a parent could not be charged with custodial interference, that is withholding custody, from the other parent. If the parent, one, had a good faith and reasonable belief that the child would be in danger if left with the other parent, and two, that parent files an emergency petition for custody, for sole custody, and receives a hearing date from the court. So all of this happened late on a Friday afternoon when the court was already closed. So I took my son out of town, came back immediately, you know, when the courts opened the next week, filed for emergency custody, got a hearing, in fact, got a hearing for that day. And while I was sitting outside of the courtroom waiting for my hearing, I was arrested. Thereafter, I was held in solitary confinement on a $50,000 cash bond. This is someone, me, who had no criminal history beyond two nonviolent misdemeanors from California more than 20 years ago. Both of them were traffic offenses. Neither of them were even DUIs. I mean, it was reckless driving. I was a stupid college kid. No criminal history beyond that. Not even so much as a speeding ticket within the past 10 years, but I was held on $50,000 cash bond and placed in solitary confinement. And later I came to find out that that is pretty much status quo for our county's prosecutor when dealing with domestic violence cases, because what they want to do is they just want to leverage a very quick plea deal. And the fastest way to get someone to plead guilty is to stick them in jail on a very high cash bond and just let them sweat it out. So what happened was I ended up pleading guilty, knowing that I was innocent, on the advice of counsel. And my attorney said, well, you know, you can just fight this in post-conviction relief. You can't appeal if you plead guilty, but there's a proceeding post-conviction relief in Arizona and many other states that permits you to challenge a conviction based on a guilty plea. The problem is that that only works on paper, because the assumption is if you plead guilty, you are guilty. And the burden to overcome that presumption is basically insurmountable. It doesn't matter what the law says. It, you know, none of that matters. It's just, well, you pled guilty, so you did it. You know, and I can go back and I can point to the law and I can say, no, under Arizona law, there was no crime. I could not be even charged for this. But, you know, none of that matters. So I took the fight to federal court. Basically.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that fight next. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joseph McGee. Joseph is in the midst of an appeal process with the state of Arizona et al. About his plea deal. Now, Joseph, when you said that the burden, if you make the guilty plea, then that is assumed solid, and that you have to implore to the court, which is difficult to do. But that belies everything that we've just said about, I mean, what you know about plea deals and what everybody seems to know about plea deals is that people make them under duress, obviously, in your situation, as you mentioned, being put in solitary confinement and for fear of getting these massive draconian charges laid on them if they don't. So, I mean, there has to be a knowledge within the system. So is this everybody just playing blind eyed here and going, oh, well, you're guilty because you said you were. And so, you know, we're closing other avenues of appeal off to you. Is this essentially what's happening?
Yeah, basically that's what goes on. You know, in my case specifically, there were body cam videos and there were audio recordings and there were records from the Arizona Department of Child Safety showing that my ex-wife had been found a neglectful mother, you know, less than, I think it was less than 2 years prior to when all this went down. All those records were concealed from me and my attorney. You know, they were never disclosed. Those obviously were very important to my defense to show, you know, good faith that, you know, look.
Well, these body cam, you mean like from police had gone to her house because somebody had called and said there's something going on here, and so they had evidence of at least police visits.
Well not only that, I mean, you know, the videos plainly showed because we had an upcoming custody trial actually less than 1 month after I was arrested. There was a trial that had been pending for more than 2 years and was delayed due to COVID. But I mean, there was audio recordings between my ex-wife and the investigating detective where, I mean, she flat out admits that her purpose in pursuing prosecution and wanting prosecution was that she would win, you know, she wouldn't lose the custody case. She would win sole custody, because how can I litigate a custody proceeding when I'm in jail and I have no access to any of my evidence or any of my exhibits or anything? Because I was self-represented. I didn't have $10,000 to drop on a family law attorney, and I didn't see a point anyway when I'd been doing it for 5 years and, you know, knew exactly how the process went.
Well, you know the old axiom, though, that the man who represents himself.
Actually, it's actually the lawyer who represents himself has a fool's client. Yeah, a lot of people misconstrue that. It's just, you know,
doesn't count for paralegals. And
no, I'm not licensed, so I figure it doesn't count for me.
Okay.
And besides, you know, I'm the person that knows my case best. You know, right. Having to explain everything to an attorney.
But does the court look at you differently? I mean, you're going in there as an appellant, which right from the top, you're saying, "Hey, court, you guys fucked up." And so that puts you on the wrong foot. And now you're not playing the game. You're not going through, you know, getting the lawyer and playing the game that the system wants you to play. You're being troublesome right off the start.
Well, yeah. And the other problem is, too, there's been a lot of research on this, that self-represented litigants, you know, they already come in with a disadvantage. But there's been a lot of research that has shown that's what's called a skilled pro se self-represented. Skilled pro se litigants are essentially doubly prejudiced, because there's, in a lot of courts at least, there's this ego that the attorneys and the judges have with regard to skilled self-represented litigants, to where it's like, you know, how dare you make these arguments? How dare you, you know, construe statutes in the manner that a skilled attorney would, when you've never been to law school? And, you know, so a lot of times, at least in my experience and other pro ses I've talked to, a lot of times you can have just rock solid legal arguments that are just ignored. And, you know, that there's nothing that you can do about that essentially at the trial court level, other than preserve your objections and make sure that you've raised every argument that you want to raise, so that you set yourself up for a successful appeal. And so that's where we're at right now with the appeal. So the lawsuit was in the Ninth Circuit, which is where I'm at, which is covers Arizona, California, about 9 other states. There is a legal doctrine that says that a judgment obtained through extrinsic fraud can be set aside by a federal court, a state court judgment. There's, I think, one other circuit that allows that. It might be the Second Circuit. But that's essentially what I was banking on, because I got no help from the state court. State court was just like, "We don't care. Like, you pled guilty. It doesn't matter if they withheld this evidence. You know, you could have requested it." And I'm like, "Well, I did request it." And I was told that it was disclosed, everything that they had.
Wait, so that's exculpatory evidence.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to ask for that?
No.
That doesn't sound right.
I don't. No. That's flat out wrong. You do not have to ask for it. Under federal law, under Brady, and later court decisions, the defense.
This is the precedent, the Brady versus Maryland 1963, yes. And it's called Brady material, or the Brady rule.
Yeah, essentially, the way it is now under federal law and under Arizona law, a defendant, whoever, does not even have to request this material. The material has to be disclosed. And under Arizona law is actually even more strict than Brady is. It must disclose within 30 days of arraignment. And it includes every statement by a witness, all recordings, you know, everything that was withheld in my case is stuff that they had to disclose within 30 days. And that didn't happen. I'm sitting in jail in solitary confinement for like 4 months. And
4 months.
This material is just not disclosed.
Months in solitary.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. Let me tell you, it was really wonderful.
Torture under international statute.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's why it's done. It's done to break you down so that you plead guilty, you know, and you know, withholding that kind of evidence, and inducing a plea deal by withholding that material that had to be disclosed, that's extrinsic fraud. Extrinsic fraud is fraud which prevents the other side from essentially having a fair day in court. So withholding all that materials is extrinsic fraud. And under Arizona law, a judgment obtained through extrinsic fraud is void. And so under Ninth Circuit precedent, a person can challenge a judgment obtained through extrinsic fraud
Is
in
this
federal
the
court.
Heck bar?
No, the Heck bar has to do, that's different. So that has to do with you can't bring a civil rights complaint for something that you were convicted for. But the thing is that I had a bunch of charges dismissed, and I had them dismissed because of the misconduct of the detective involved. So I sued the detective and my ex-wife for civil rights violations, and the argument that their attorney made is, oh, well, there was a conviction, so you can't proceed on the civil rights claim. And I mean, that's just not true, because the indictment itself was later dismissed based on that misconduct. And
Well,
so,
this is starting to sound Kafkaesque.
oh yeah, oh yeah.
Well, Joseph, okay, we're fast running out of time. We only got a couple minutes here now. So where it stands right now, you've got you're in the appellant court. You mentioned that this you're challenging a lower federal courts and how the lower courts deal with Supreme Court precedent. You say that federal courts are not bound by clearly erroneous Supreme Court precedents. What are those precedents that you're challenging, the Supreme Court, erroneous Supreme Court precedents?
So in the United States, we have something called Section 1983, which is a federal civil rights statute that allows people who are wronged by state officials acting under color of law to proceed with a damages claim. Initially, there was no immunity under this statute. As originally enacted by Congress in 1871, there was to be no immunity. They created this doctrine of qualified immunity,
You
that he can't be held liable.
dropped
And
away
fast forward
there.
about 15 years.
Oh, sorry, we're having some communication challenges here, Joseph. But you were mentioning qualified immunity, and in your brief, in the conclusion, you say Congress's intent to protect citizens from government abuse cannot be overridden by judges who think they know better. I love that phrase, and this is to do with qualified immunity. In our last minute, can you describe what qualified immunity is and how it pertains to
Oh,
this case?
yes, because correct. So essentially, what the Supreme Court did when they created qualified immunity was they just ignored the 1871 Civil Rights Act. They ignored the legislative debate, which focused on the fact that no one would be immune, not even judges would be immune to liability under this act. The Supreme Court in 1967 just essentially ignored it and said, well, we're gonna create this immunity. And about 15 years later, in a case called Harlow v. Fitzgerald, the Supreme Court said, well, the good faith standard really isn't workable because too many of these cases are going to trial, but we're not going to explain what that entails. And now, since that time, the Supreme Court has only found a violation of clearly established law in Section 1983 in 6% of cases. So, 94% of the time, when a Section 1983 case makes it to the Supreme Court is siding with police because they're saying, well, the law wasn't clearly established, even though we're not going to explain what clearly established even means. And we're just essentially going to create these vague terms that really no one understands. And, let's be honest, this was not to protect police, because police are already indemnified. Almost entirely, 98% of police, according to recent studies, are indemnified by the employers against liability for this. So this was really created to protect insurance companies. Let's be honest. So in the 42 years since that time, the Supreme Court has repeatedly reminded the lower federal courts that they must comply with Supreme Court precedent, no matter how wrong they think the court was. But that notion was also invented. It was invented the same way qualified immunity was invented. There's nothing under the Constitution that says that the Supreme Court can rewrite lawful acts of Congress to create immunities from thin air. And so essentially what I'm urging the Ninth Circuit to do is to just ignore this clearly erroneous Supreme Court precedent, which was created in complete excess of any Supreme Court jurisdiction to do so. Supreme Court cannot rewrite laws. That's not something they can do. They can strike down a law if it's unconstitutional, but what they can't do is say, well, we don't really like that so many cops are being held liable for this, so we're gonna create these immunities. That's just not something that's permitted under our Constitution.
Well, you say that you're getting a lot of interest from when you're on your Twitter feed from lawyers and judges and jurists from all over America. They're following your case. When, Joseph, is your case heard? Do you have a date yet?
Don't have a date yet. There's still one motion pending. So briefing has concluded in the appeal, but there's still a motion pending that I filed. I'm going to be filing the final thing on that motion. And then I expect that the court will set the matter for oral argument, probably to take place in December, if I had to guess. The question is will the court, will the court order a panel, which is three judges, or will it order oral argument in bank, which is, like whatever, 16, 18, I don't remember how many, it's a lot of judges.
The more the better, I think, is for you, right?
Exactly.
Well, Joseph, we're out of time, but I mean, if you listeners want to follow the progress, you can hook up with Joseph's Twitter X site, Rad Legal Takes. That's at RAD Legal Takes, and follow the progress as he goes up against the Arizona Appellate Ninth Circuit Court and more. Thanks a lot for coming on, Joseph.
Thank you. It was Rad Legal Takes.
Rad Legal Takes. Yeah, we're really breaking up. Thanks again, Joseph. And thanks, too, to Laith Marouf in Lebanon under the bombing right now. That's all I got this week. Until the next time.
With a system that doesn't want us existing, turn a city to a prison that's missing living conditions. My mom's calling. She's telling me she kind of scared. I hear the bombs falling. I smell a death up in the air. My uncle lost his children. I lost my cousins. His tears watered the grave to let him know we still love some. Our schools turn to shelters for the rich and poor. I just pray for peace when I speak. I don't wish for war. Bodies laying out, ain't nothing to play about. I give my people hope, cause I'm the first who made it out. I'm just walking the path, this is God's plan. Building up my dreams with the rubble I touch with my hands. Away that power of the almighty dollar sign. Fuck the allure. We'll boycott the stores. Capitalism killing us. That's something we can't afford. They want us to hate each other in the interest of war. Afraid of the mosque and afraid of like the menorah. Hey, Kamala, I don't know if you listening, but stop sending money and weapons or you ain't winning. Michigan, we uncommitted. And hell no, we ain't switching positions because the whole world turned Palestinian. I see the murdered children of Gaza and I see my babies. Life being stripped from the bombs we're making. When will Congress decide a Palestinian's life is just as precious as an Israeli's? We don't own the earth, don't own the earth. We're killing each other over some lines in the dirt. We bleed the same blood, feel the same hurt. Palestinian life, does it have the same worth? What happened to us? What happened to us?